Well, I think it demonstrates an inappropriate emphasis on the part of the commentators. This idea that somehow poverty will be addressed through UN resolutions or through General Assembly documents or through the provision of aid or UN conferences is simply a myth. It's a fallacy. It won't happen at the UN. The key to addressing poverty issues is on the ground in poor nations themselves. If you take a look at the record on development, you find that the key to policy change, which is at the heart of economic growth and development, is a domestic will to change those policies. It can't be forced in from the outside. IMF and the World Bank have experimented for years with conditionality, trying to force countries to change when they're unwilling. It hasn't worked. You need to have a commitment by countries to adopt good policies, policies that lead to economic freedom, lead to good governance, and bolster the rule of law, and create an environment under which private sector entrepreneurship, private sector investment is encouraged, and an environment that reduces the risk that aid that is provided, which can be helpful in some circumstances, is not going to be wasted or subject to corrupt purposes.
Now, it was, I understand, difficult for many at the UN to reach a consensus. Some have blamed so-called spoilers. One U.S. official named in the press had said that countries like Pakistan, Egypt, Iran, Venezuela, Sudan, and Cuba had been involved in derailing more robust action in establishing a UN human rights mechanism. And there are others who criticize U.S. Ambassador to the UN, John Bolton. They say that he offered too many amendments to the final document. From your understanding, what are some of the internal dynamics that makes it so hard for the UN to reach a consensus on a poverty alleviation and UN reform issues?
Well, I think by the very nature of this document, which seeks to incorporate such a broad swath of ideas and concepts and initiatives, such ranging from development to international peace and security to human rights to the rule of law to United Nations reform, what you're doing is every country at the United Nations will have its own priorities among all these different issues that it would like to see advanced, and also areas where it objects to proposals by other nations. And by having a comprehensive document, what you're inviting is horse trading. And the inevitable result of this will be a watered-down document that lacks teeth, that lacks assertiveness in most areas, because, quite frankly, one country may want human rights reform or reform the Human Rights Commission, and another nation might not. And that nation may want development assistance, and another nation may not. And so, in order to reach a consensus document, both countries will have to fall off their position. So I think that it's inappropriate to blame the spoilers, but perhaps it's more appropriate to blame the concept in general. I think each of these individual issues has merit and needs to be addressed, but by addressing them all together, you're inviting a process that is not going to be very constructive.
Some have said that this summit and the document was an effort to boost multilateralism, especially after the failure of many members of the UN to back the U.S., for example, in toppling Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And what does this tell us about multilateralism at the UN? Is there still hope for it, or is it failing?
Well, it depends on the topic and what you're talking about. It's an interesting, the United Nations is a useful forum in which a number of different countries can express their views and divergent points of opinion can be voiced. But I think you're hoping for too much when you ask the United Nations to come up with an effective plan that is that meets the standard of consensus for all nations. Other things are out there that provide a much more effective, nimble process for actually reaching results. And I don't think that the UN should be regarded as the alpha and the omega of all these the multilateral efforts. There are other options.
The New York Times editorial today had said this week's summit meeting should have strengthened international commitments to reach broadly accepted development benchmarks over the next decade that it says could avert tens of thousands of needless deaths from extreme poverty. You are against the use of benchmarks, are you not?
I don't think that the Millennium Development Goals as listed out, and by that I'm talking about the 48 different indicators that are identified by the UN as benchmarks for accomplishing the Millennium Development Goals, are in and of themselves constitute a development strategy. They are data points. They provide an idea of where countries are in terms of progress. But simply pursuit of improving those goals do not constitute a development strategy. Developing countries need to have economic growth. The World Bank itself recognizes this. It says achievement of the Millennium Development Goals requires at least 7% growth among countries, the developing countries, in order to meet them. So by ignoring the focus on economic growth, you're ignoring the means by which you achieve a sustainable progress toward those Millennium Development Goals. In essence, it's a measurement of the symptoms rather than a measurement of the cure for the disease of poverty.
President Bush addressed the UN today, and in part of his remarks, he urged the elimination of agricultural tariffs and other barriers that he said distort trade and stunt development. He pledged that the United States is ready to eliminate tariffs, subsidies, and other barriers to the free flow of goods and services. As he said, other nations do the same. Do you see much hope of that in upcoming sessions of the UN?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely a very constructive policy pursuit. Other organizations have estimated, including the World Bank, have estimated that hundreds of billions of dollars could be realized in poor countries through the elimination of subsidies and other trade barriers on agricultural goods in the United States and in the European Union. I think that's absolutely positive and, moreover, a far more constructive way of creating incentives for economic growth in poor countries than simply through income transfers like foreign assistance. In this way, you're actually bolstering opportunities in the private sector, which creates jobs and creates a dynamic economic development model among poor nations, rather than simply a top-down model of government-designed aid programs.
Do you think it's likely that the strong agricultural blocks in the U.S. and the European Union, particularly in France, are likely to be willing to eliminate subsidies to agriculture?
Well, that's always the trick, isn't it? The United States has said for a while that is ready to eliminate agricultural subsidies and barriers as soon as the EU does. And the EU, led by France and other countries, has proven very resistant to that. And I don't want to downplay the influence of groups, agricultural lobbies in the United States who are going to resist this as well, but I think that you could accomplish that in the United States if you do have a commitment from the European Union, because a lot of the arguments made by these groups would lose a lot of credibility. What's important to know is that the overarching goal remains the same no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. You want to see poor countries develop. You want African countries to increase their standards of living. What I think is inappropriate is through the MDGs or the focus on the 0.7% of GDP and foreign assistance targets, you're focusing on inputs or on benchmarks rather than on what will actually resolve the problem. And the solution to the problem in poor countries is good policies, good governance, economic freedom, the rule of law, and which provides the environment for not only foreign investment but domestic investment and entrepreneurship to develop, but also removes opportunities for corruption that have held back development in those countries for far too long. And we need to emphasize not only the responsibilities of developed countries, but also the responsibilities of developing country governments to create environments under which economic freedom and individual liberty can be seized and taken advantage of by their own citizens.